Hello and welcome to Ancient Futures, where we talk about gaps between theory and practice and try to do better. Today, it's a different sort of podcast. I'm sharing a recording from the Oxford Literary Festival, where I recently spoke at an event titled Religion and Animal Welfare, right before a former Archbishop of Canterbury, so no pressure. I was in theory presenting a Hindu perspective, so I had to start by explaining that I'm not myself a Hindu, before talking in general about some ideas that have influenced yogis, Jains and Buddhists, among many others. The event was co-organised by Compassion in World Farming, and we talked quite a bit about compassion more broadly. Now, their former chief executive, Joyce De Silva, has written a book about the treatment of animals in different religions, which was the springboard for our conversation. You can find out more about that via the link in the show notes. It's a comprehensive guide to some very inspiring ideas, but also to why they're not always observed. Now, to support Compassion in World Farming, I've joined a list of rather more illustrious luminaries who are speaking on behalf of their vision, and there's a link to that too. For more about this podcast and ways to support it as a subscriber, go to ancientfutures.substack.com. But for now though, let's explore the transformative power of compassion with Joyce De Silva, Amir Khan, George Carey, and our host for the day, Francine Stock.
Thank you very much, and hello everyone. It's a fascinating subject, I think, a very controversial subject that we're going to be discussing over the next hour or so. Really, religion and animal welfare, I suppose, fundamentally we consider, can good people do bad things while believing that they're leading good lives, but do bad things to other creatures without necessarily being aware of any cruelty? It's a huge subject, and we've assembled a particularly fascinating, I think, and experienced and eminent panel here to discuss it today. We're going to talk about the interpretation and sometimes perhaps willful misunderstanding of sacred texts. The format is that each of the speakers will speak for 5 minutes or so, then we'll have some discussion here. But then I would like to invite you also to participate in that. And at the end of the session, there will be an opportunity for you to get some of the books that our speakers have written, and they'll be signing at the back there. So I'm going to start by inviting the woman who's latest book actually gives the title to this session, which is Religion and Animal Welfare, Teaching and Practice. And that's Joyce De Silva, who is former chief executive of Compassion in World Farming. Joyce.
Okay. Good morning, or good afternoon, possibly. I just want to really talk about what my book is about, and I thought I should have brought a copy with me. I know, Archbishop Carey, you've got a copy, perhaps you can hold it up. Thank you. So 80% of the world's population say that they belong to a particular faith, and it could be a Judeo-Christian faith, which teaches that animals are God's creatures. Some faiths believe that animals actually praise God. Or it could be one of the, perhaps, faiths like Hinduism and Buddhism, which faiths believe that animals are sentient beings and, like humans, get reborn. But I thought I'd like to just give you a little taster of some of the lovely religious teachings that I found when I was researching my book. So, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, the god Krishna teaches that the divine exists in all beings and says, wise ones see the selfsame thing in a Brahmin, that's a priest, wise and courteous, as in a cow or in an elephant or a dog. And then the Buddhists have a wonderful prayer the loving kindness prayer, which says, may all beings everywhere be happy. May they be healthy. May they be at peace. May they be free. And then there's probably one of my favorite Christian saints, Isaac the Syrian. He was 8th century, and he described a merciful heart as a heart on fire for the whole of creation, for humanity, for the birds, for the animals, and for all that exists. And then the Sikhs have a revered book, the Guru Granth Sahib, which says the merit of pilgrimages to the 68 holy places and that of other virtues besides do not equal having compassion for other living beings. And the Quran declares that animals are communities like yourselves and that Allah cares for his creatures. And one verse in the Quran says, there's not a creature that moves on earth whose provision is not his concern. He knows where it lives and its final resting place. So, I mean, that's just to give you an idea of some of the many beautiful teachings in the holy books. And yet, what happens to animals in this world? Their welfare is ignored. Globally, over 80 billion animals a year are slaughtered for our food, and trillions of fishes. The vast majority of the animals are crowded in industrial factory farms, either crowded closely together or isolated individually, so they can never have sort of normal social interaction with each other. And many have their bodies modified through breeding methods so that they grow very fast, like chickens, or that they have a very high yield, like dairy cows. And this fast growth really throws their bodies out of sync, and they often develop painful conditions like lameness. Other animals are subjected to surgical procedures like castration, tail docking, and beak trimming. And usually this is done without any pain relief. And well over 100 million animals are used for animal experimentation every year. Others for tourist rides, entertainment, so-called sports like cockfighting, bullfighting, hunting. So there seems to be a sort of disconnect between the teaching and the reality on the ground. But several faith leaders, both past and present, have exemplified care for animals in their lives or in their teaching. And the medieval Jewish scholar Maimonides wrote, it should not be believed that all the beings exist for the sake of the existence of humanity. On the contrary, all the other beings too have been intended for their own sakes. And that's been a big bone of contention, if you like, you know, are animals there for us or are they here for themselves? There was a really famous 19th century Hindu leader, Swami Vivekananda, and he said, in every man and in every animal resides the same omnipresent, omniscient soul. Between me and the smallest animal, the difference is only in manifestation. But as a principle, he's the same as I am. He is my brother. He has the same soul as I have. And in the Hindu side as well, of course, Mahatma Gandhi said quite a lot about animals, including, to my mind, the life of a lamb is not less precious than that of a human being. I should be unwilling to take the life of a lamb for the sake of the human body. And last week, a group of Islamic scholars published, with support from the United Nations, a document called Al-Mizan, which means the balance, a covenant for the earth. And it says, most destructive, most wasteful by far, are industrial farms that poison the soil, air, and water, that replace the diversity of native plants with sterile monocultures, and industrial livestock production facilities such as poultry farms, feedlots, slaughterhouses, dairies, and industrial fisheries. In June 2015, Pope Francis issued a radical encyclical, which I'm sure many of you heard about, called Laudato Si. And in that encyclical, he proposes an ecological conversion, which entails, I'm quoting, entails a loving awareness that we are not disconnected from the rest of creatures, but joined in a splendid universal communion. So there are all these really lovely things teachers are saying and holy books are saying, and it's an anomaly. Actually, it's kind of a scandal that there's all the teaching and the examples and so on, and yet animals are still subjected to so many horrors in this world. So I'd like to challenge people of faith and their leaders to study at least the teaching of their own faith regarding our relationship with animals. And then, you know, do something about it, put it into practice. But it's really great to have faith colleagues here today who are doing just that. So that's lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Joyce. Thanks very much indeed. So Amir Khan, who's our next speaker, identifies as Muslim, as a GP in Bradford, and specializes in type 2 diabetes, which is fairly topical in terms of the whole food business and debate at the moment, but also is very well known from television appearances, on, for example, Good Morning Britain, and indeed his own series. But he is also president of the RSPB and vice president of the Wildlife Trust. So that's a pretty broad portfolio there. Amir, would you like to take the podium?
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to be here today. As was said earlier, I am Muslim, but disclaimer, I'm not the most practicing Muslim, but I do identify as that. And I think that's true for a lot of people, isn't it? There's a spectrum when it comes to religion and how much you immerse yourself in that. But I do believe in the fundamental teachings of Islam. And as I've got older, I feel like I found my religion. Again, I think we all go through that period when we're a bit younger, when we rebel a little bit. And I didn't feel like I belonged in my religion when I was younger growing up, but certainly now I found a way to make that work for me. And one of the things that does work for me is Islam's teaching on animal welfare. And that is something that isn't often talked about enough when it comes to how Islam is portrayed in the public domain, in the media. There's a lot of discourse around Muslims, Islam, politics right now, and there are, I'll be honest with you, it's quite difficult being a Muslim in this country in the current state of affairs. It's difficult being a brown person in this country. Just over the last few days, you can see what's been happening around politics and racism and calling that out or not calling it out. And I think when you actually strip most religions, if not all of them, back to what they should be, they have so much in common, but when it comes to animal welfare, a lot of that is steeped in respect for animals, and Islam is no different. But actually what you hear and see or read about is misconceptions around what halal meat is, and I'll come on to that. And how animals are treated. And I think what happens, and this happens all through minority or historically discriminated populations and religions, is that an individual or a small number of people may mistreat or misconstrue how animals might be treated, and that is then reflected upon an entire population. And that doesn't happen when you're not a historically marginalized population. It only happens really to us. And that's not just in animal welfare, that's across the board when it comes to behavior for historically marginalized groups. But actually the truth of it, when it comes to what Islam teaches about animal welfare, and we believe that all animals are God's creatures and they have consciences. And according to the Quran, the animals praise God. And even if that praise isn't expressed in human language, they are praising him. And baiting animals for entertainment or gambling is prohibited in our religion. And it's forbidden to kill any animal except for food or to protect another person. So all of that is around kind of the welfare and how we should be treating animals. And Joyce talked a little bit about animals being considered as part of communities and that what their welfare is really important. And that is taught in our text. We are allowed to kill animals for nourishment, food, but anything beyond that, particularly, you know, anything for entertainment or game hunting is strictly prohibited. And that's really clear in our scriptures. And that did resonate with me. I'll be honest with you, I'm a vegetarian, so I don't eat meat at all. And sometimes I get comments around that from a religious point of view. My mum is not a fan of that, if I'm being honest. She always says, well, now I have to cook two meals, one for you and one for everyone else. But I said, actually, mum, you can just eat vegetarian food. But yeah, she's come to terms with it now. And also from a health point of view, people ask me, well, actually, you know, is it healthy to be vegetarian? Can you get by on meat free diets? And the answer to that is quite easily a yes. Yes, you can. You know, part of what I do in the work of type 2 diabetes is talking about food and nourishment. That is better than any medicine that I can give people with type 2 diabetes. And I talk about that with my patients and actually having, you know, working with them, because I don't put my beliefs onto them, but I will talk to them about the benefits of plant-based food and actually reducing the amount of meat consumption, particularly red meat consumption, when it comes to things like high risk of colorectal cancer. So I've got to put that out there, because sometimes my belief in plant-based diets and animal welfare can feel like it is at juxtaposition with my religion, but it's not. It's really not. The two of them go really well together, because part of Islam's teaching is looking after your own body, because it's a gift from God. And being healthy is actually a blessing, and it's something we get rewards for in heaven as well. We get kind of points as we go along life. and the more good deeds you do, you collect these points, and that means, you know, you get more time in heaven. And so looking after yourself and having a healthy diet, and for me that means a plant-based diet high in antioxidants, is actually good for me here, but it will be good for me in the afterlife as well. So really, really important. But I guess it feels like a controversial subject, but it's not, is halal meat. And people will, whenever I post anything about animal welfare on social media, inevitably I will get comments about, well, why don't you talk to your own people about halal meat and the butchering of animals and the suffering of animals when it comes to halal meat. But actually, Islam's teaching on the slaughter of animals for food is all about keeping pain to a minimum and making death swift for them. And that does not get talked about enough. You know, if you go to France, they want to ban halal meat there. And that, you know, is in keeping with some of the other policies they've put in place, which I think are anti-Muslim. But actually, they haven't got to the bottom of what halal meat is. You know, it's supposed to be, you stun the animal first, and then you swiftly cut its throat. And that sounds brutal in itself, but you've got to be honest about what it is. And it's the jugular vein, the carotid artery, and the windpipe are supposed to go all in one sharp movement. And that will mean that the animal loses consciousness very quickly. And because it's stunned, it's supposed to be minimal pain. I haven't been through it, obviously, myself. We can't ask the animals, but that's the idea behind it. And like any slaughter process, people don't always follow the rules. And that isn't right, and that should be called out. But what shouldn't happen is that that shouldn't be a reflection on an entire religion and an entire way animals are killed and how they're supposed to be killed. And that is what Joyce was talking about, really. You know, what is written and what is happening in practice may be two different things, but that is on the individuals. It's not on the religion itself. And that again, that whole kind of debate, it all gets so toxic so quickly when these debates happen, but it doesn't have to be that way. And I do think we've got to have honest, open debates about these things, or conversations about these things, but without it escalating into an us and them kind of situation. So that is really the angle that I'm coming at it from. You know, we have to be honest about it. Individuals' actions are not reflective of an entire community or an entire religion, but the teaching in our religion is very much about animal welfare, minimal pain, and only killing animals for food or protection. Anything beyond that is not Islam. It's not being a Muslim. And those people who are doing anything beyond that are not acting in an Islamic way. And we've got to be really clear about those lines. Misconstruing that, mixing the two up, reflecting people's behavior on an entire population is racism. And there is a lot of that going on when it comes to this debate. And so I'm happy to answer questions around that, but that's the angle I'm coming in at this. So thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you, Amir. Thank you. Well, Daniel Simpson teaches here in Oxford at the Centre for Hindu Studies and also in London at SOAS. He's the author of The Truth of Yoga, and indeed is, you know, we'll speak now, I think, about the practice of Hinduism and animal welfare.
Thank you all. It's an honour to be here. And I should probably clarify, first of all, that I'm not actually a Hindu. I am, however, a scholar of ancient Indian traditions, particularly yoga. And as a result of my interest in yoga, I have read a lot of ancient Indian sacred texts, not just from the Hindu tradition. And yeah, I hope that sort of mix of insider-outsider perspectives will help me get a little bit of context on some of the ideas that come out of the Hindu tradition and why, as Joyce points out, they're not always respected in practice. The first thing to say really is, from the point of view of yoga, if we to ask all of you what yoga means, I bet we get a majority for making shapes on mats, which is the general understanding of this word in the modern world. That's not what it meant until very recently indeed. And really, to think about yoga in its broadest context, it's a way of relating to reality. And so that starts with how we behave. And the very first item on the list of precepts is ahimsa in Sanskrit, which means non-harming. As Joyce pointed out, Gandhi made it famous, promoting non-violence as the foundation of his political philosophy, which influenced lots of other activist movements around the world. But if you go to the best-known text on yoga philosophy, the Yoga Sutra, and the 31st Sutra of the second chapter, to be specific, it says that the rule of non-harming should not be limited by species. So this is not about people, it's about beings. And actually, there is a line of commentary that unpacks that, says this should be respected in all situations with regard to all objects in absolutely every way without exception. Now, that's quite a fundamentalist kind of statement in a way that it's almost impossible to live up to. But that comes, I think, originally from the renouncer traditions that gave us yoga, who were really trying to eliminate all sources of harm because that was what drove the process of rebirth. To keep it as simple as possible. And this is an idea you don't just find in Hinduism, it's also the foundation of Buddhism, Jainism, and those vows that you get in yoga philosophy have been most clearly articulated in the earliest Jain text, and Jain renouncers will take all care that they possibly can to avoid harming even beings they can't see, covering their mouths to stop inhaling anything, sweeping the ground before they set foot on it to try and avoid stamping on anything. So you can take this idea very far indeed, and not many people do. Nonetheless, the basis of it is, as Joyce again was pointing out, the idea that there is the same self in all beings. And the word being is used in Sanskrit. This is bhuta, and it comes from the verb to be, literally. So there isn't a distinction made between humans and other living creatures. In some contexts, even inanimate objects are seen in the same way. The Bhagavad Gita says, by perceiving this same true self everywhere, a person will not harm the same self by means of themselves. So there is this, again, fairly fundamentalist statement of anything other than that is a contradiction of religious principles. However, it's not quite so simple. The verse that Joyce was quoting about seeing a priest, a cow, an elephant, and a dog equally, ends also with a reference to an outcast. So they should also be seen equally, if you've got this highest vision, the same self in all beings, but it alludes to the fact that there is a hierarchical structure of society built into Hinduism, the caste system. And the actual word in Sanskrit for that outcast is shvapaka, one who cooks dogs. So you're seeing equally everybody, who is even at the bottom of the pile, basically, beyond the pale in society, eating the animal which is seen at the bottom of the pile, out of probably economic necessity. So we have to recognize that some of these principles come into collision with worldly reality at some point. In fact, the whole basis of this idea of non-harming is really to contradict the earliest form of the Hindu religion, the Vedic ritual tradition, which goes back thousands of years and was founded on sacrificing animals, making offerings into a fire to feed the gods, who would in return feed us by providing auspicious conditions for human flourishing. So there was, in that context, a sense that animals, very prized possessions, but because they're so prized, we can make an offering of them to appease the natural order of things so that it will ensure that we get what we need. In and amongst that as well, there are ways in which some of the revered sages of ancient India made no bones about boasting of their love of eating meat. So Hindus are supposed to, in popular understanding, revere the cow. Not only were cows sacrificed, not only were they given away as prizes in ancient philosophical debates, this famous sage Yajnavalkya said he loved to eat them, especially when they were tender. Because that's what happened. The meat was cooked, it was then given back to priests for consumption. So the yogic renouncer traditions often point to this as part of the reason for coming into existence, saying it's a reform movement in a way, saying that has got no way of answering the fundamental questions of existence. It doesn't deal with the problems that drive human suffering, therefore we need to think differently. So over time, because Hinduism is a very adaptive way of seeing things, it wasn't really an ism until the British stamped that label on it, it's a collection of different ways of seeing the world. It accommodated this idea about non-harming. Nonetheless, go to modern India, although the cow is supposedly revered, they walk around eating cardboard boxes and plastic bags. They are put through one of the world's biggest dairy industries. The whole concept of pure vegetarianism in India also exists alongside maximal consumption of dairy products. So there's a long way to go with respect for animals in that sense. Even respect for cows is caught up with Hindu nationalism. Cow protection mobs go around as vigilantes attacking Muslims who eat beef. So this is weaponized by the Hindu nationalist government as part of its strategy of divide and rule. Finally, though, I think we should come back to the idea that somewhere amidst all of this, there are some core principles that are supposed to be timeless and are supposed to apply across traditions, not just to Hindus. They are referred to with a label that Hindus sometimes say is the true name of their religion, Sanatana Dharma, the eternal doctrine or law or teachings, we could say. Similar phrase you find also in other traditions, in the Dhammapada, for example, a Buddhist text. There's a similar idea in Jainism as well. And whenever statements are made about this eternal doctrine, it comes back to the principle of non-harming. Never displaying malice to any creature is the fundamental basis of that. That is the essence of this way of being, way of seeing. So for that to be embodied, we have to look beyond this narrow sense of who we are. And that's where the self in all beings idea really comes into its own. It's not just about people. It's not just about tribes. It's about our relationship to broader reality. And as I started out by saying, that's the essence of yoga philosophy, if you really want to embody it. These texts do have a lot they can teach us, but it's very easy through processes of cognitive dissonance to imagine we're doing one thing, as Francine was pointing out at the beginning, while doing something very different. So I'll leave it there for now.
Thank you, Daniel. And finally, in this particular stage of the discussion, a man who really needs no introduction at all, Lord Carey, George Carey, who of course was Archbishop from 1991 to 2002, theologian and author of, amongst other books, a book which I believe, you know, never always sounds so timely, which is God Incarnate, Meeting the Contemporary Challenges to a Classic Christian Doctrine. And still we go on doing that, don't we? So with your response to this, please.
Well, thank you, Francine, very much indeed. And it's a real privilege to be here in a chapel that I know pretty well. I do want to begin by thanking Joyce for this book. And I want to encourage you to get a copy, because I think it's a really pivotal, interesting, and timely book, timely in terms of what it has to say. And I've learnt a lot from it. Thank you. I don't know if, like me, you were touched by what Amir said, how difficult it is to be a Muslim in our country. It touched me because I think people of faith ought to be reaching out to one another, trying to create a world which is one we want to leave to our children and grandchildren, and we have a long way to go. So thank you, Joyce. Thank you, Amir. Thank you, Daniel and Francine. Now, Christianity has been criticized, actually, in my view, fairly and properly, for many years, for its cruel attitude to animals and for its anthropomorphism and unkind attitude toward the animal world. It has been exaggerated because the truth is, on the one hand, there's been a tendency for Christianity to drive the industrialization of the West, one of the great successes. At the same time, actually, the emphasis upon God created man and woman in his own image has led to the separation between humankind and the rest. And I want to say, actually, some of that is true, a lot of it is false. What's happening? I want to say that the things are moving within the Christian world. Things are changing, and in what way? Let me give you 5 points, and I have to be very quick because the chairman will be on to me if I don't keep to my 5 or 6 minutes. And the first is to do with reading our theology again. For example, actually, if you go to the King James Version of the Bible and you look at Genesis 1, you'll find an emphasis that that wonderful version puts upon meat. But if you go to Genesis 1, 28 and 29, you won't find the word meat at all, because meat is basar in Hebrew, and the word there is okla, which means food, and it's referring to vegetables. So immediately you have to start looking at what the Bible is saying, because sometimes the translation gets in the way. Point number two has to do with the way we've been looking again at theology and up-and-coming theologians. Andrew Lindsay, very well known in this university, has been for many years a pioneer. David Clough, a Methodist, recently written a 2-volume work on animals, claiming to be the first systematic Christian theological exploration of the animal world. And alongside this, there's been the way in which we've looked at our tradition again. Are you aware, if you look at Genesis 2, the care for animals, Isaiah 11, and suddenly we are starting to reflect more deeply on the way our history has been treated. Think of the so-called Cappadocian fathers, Basil of Caesarea, Francis Assisi. So many people in history have been working and caring for creation. Another factor, I think, has to be the arising moral sense that our attitude towards animals has been very cruel, that we've abused them and mistreated them badly. Now, Joyce has very helpfully referred to the Roman Catholic encyclical Pope Francis' Laudato Si, which is a magnificent piece of writing. I do commend it. And the emphasis is upon our common home, what we share together with the animal creation. It's something that I do commend very much indeed. Another factor has to be, and this is where younger people particularly have been caught up in this, the direct link between animal production and exploitation of the earth. Meat production significantly contributes to the release of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and other gases as well. And as these large volumes of greenhouse gases accumulate in the Earth's atmosphere, then of course we all suffer. And it's difficult to argue with Pope Francis' word, the Earth, our home, is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth. In summary, a great deal of thinking is going on in our churches about caring for animals, and certainly an increasingly number of younger people are choosing the vegetarian option. And there's excellent evidence that plant-based foods require less energy, produce less emissions than animal products. And few Christians nowadays think that nature exists to serve humanity. And there's a general acceptance that human dominion over nature should be seen as stewardship, which actually is a biblical idea, and partnership rather than exploitation. So, Madam Chairman, as I finish, I believe that modern Christians are beginning to think that we are stewards of creation, that we should be more sympathetic to animals, less willing to accept that there's an unbridgeable gap between animals and human beings. And as St. Francis of Assisi said, animals are part of God's creation and as such deserve respect and protection. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you all very much indeed for that. I suppose the thing that immediately springs to mind is that you're all acknowledging that there is a kind of a shortfall quite often between what the sacred texts actually state and the way that it's practiced. And I'm wondering whether there is much emphasis on interfaith collaboration on this issue. And also, even if there is, culturally, a lot of the readings of the ways that we have understood these texts in terms of putting human beings, as it were, at the top of the billing, and of the ideas of sacrifice and all these things, all the language, all the imagery, that is so many thousands of years. I mean, how easy is it to overturn that? Sorry, big question.
Well, I mean, I know there is an organisation called the Animal Interfaith Alliance in this country, and I believe there are some others in the States and so on, but they're not huge. But they do definitely welcome new members. So look it up, Animal Interfaith Alliance.
I think it's such a complicated issue. So I think working together as religions is really important on a number of levels, not just for this, but to bring people together as a whole. But there's so much more than religion that drives people's food choices. And I think a lot of people, certainly where I work, in inner city Bradford, it's a very socially deprived area. And a lot of them would like to be more compassionate towards animals, you know, if you break it down. But that isn't their priority when it comes to food choices. It's just about eating and being full and feeding their children. And I think, yes, the religions do need to come together and share this information that we know is there in our religious texts. But we also need to make accessibility to food easier for communities so they can make those choices based on what they really want to do rather than what is necessary for them.
Yeah. Sort of nodding forward to our politics of food session at 2 p.m. as well. So there was a... Yes, done.
Well, I think politics is part of it, definitely. Really, that's just to do with how we live in the polis. So it's how we relate to each other, coming back to what I was speaking about a little bit. And if we're going to talk about the yoga world, which is really my domain, I suppose, that's full of people who would call themselves spiritual but not religious. So I think interfaith dialogue needs to go beyond conventional ideas of what faith groups are, really. It's about, you know, humanitarian thinking, and it's not even about humans in the end, it's about, you know, this perspective on being. So in some ways I think we have to rethink who we're talking to, how we're speaking, if we actually want to reach people. And then even so, we still have to make that compatible with the reality that, you know, we live in a world in which we're encouraged to think of ourselves as members of one tribe and to see others as lesser than us somehow. So we need to engage with that as well. It's not easy, obviously. It is, you know, the problems of human beings and the problems of life itself, but that's what we're talking about.
And that sort of leads on to something that you referred to, Lucari, which is the sort of force majeure of the environment and the effect on the environment, which in a sense is becoming so apparently pressing as an issue to people of faith and others as well. I mean, is that something in which you believe, for example, that the Christian church may be taking more leadership in future?
Well, I think the point I was making earlier about younger people probably being more aware than my generation of the damage we're doing to creation, and looking at the evidence all around us, the quotation from Pope Francis. But really working back into your earlier question, what we seem to be doing here, I mean, we're actually engaging in a faith issue by focusing on something we have in common and that we need, which is food. And our problem today is that we're all so sophisticated, we're miles and miles away from where it all begins. In other words, what food to us is what we see in shops. So we're miles away from the beginning of the process, and we need to get back into nature more than we're doing. And it makes me, it's very odd in a way, I often think to myself, what is the most popular food in Britain? I think it's Indian cooking.
Chicken tikka masala.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a reminder, isn't it, that and most of that is vegetable-based anyway, isn't it? I'm not a vegetarian, but I think I ought to be more of one, increasingly so. But when I go into the Indian cuisine, I feel really tempted that I could actually enjoy this every day. So there's a sense in which we need to actually explore what we're eating, why we enjoy it, and how we can benefit everyone from our exploration together.
I'm conscious that we don't have unlimited time, so I would like to invite questions from the audience. There's a roving microphone if anybody would like to put up a hand. Any questions? Oh, there we go. Here, just here first. Oh, sorry, I have that microphone.
Thank you very much. Hello, thank you all so much. My question is it
possible that religion is not, oh, sorry, is not going to solve this, because you've made such beautiful cases, particularly Joyce, your summary at the beginning, for how all the texts of all the major religions give us guidance towards compassion, towards animals, and yet it's not happening. And to your point, or is it Daniel? Yeah, that it strikes me that the ability to feel compassionate towards animals is the same as the ability to feel compassionate towards one another. Compassion generally is something that needs to be fostered. And in our increasingly divisive world, separateness and definitions and, you know, tribalism of one kind or another don't seem to be helping us to behave in a more compassionate way to one another, to the to the creatures in the soil, to the beef cattle, etc. So is religion going to help us, going to get us there?
Well, I would just like to pick up on that word compassion, and it's something that, you know, came to my attention about 15 years ago now. I think Karen Armstrong, an author who writes about comparative religion, was involved in the creation of something called the Charter for Compassion, and emphasizing that this principle is there in all religious traditions. So again, trying to find this common ground and finding something that we can build on that. But it's, you know, it's clear, you're right. I can't see how, if there is this shortfall and there is also the sense of division out there in the world, that, you know, any particular religious tradition is going to fix this. People have to fix this, and we all have to fix this individually in our moment-to-moment choices. And you know, part of that is how we actually relate to ourselves, you know, to have compassion for ourselves and to try and do the best we can, acknowledging that we're going to fall short, but we're going to keep trying to do a bit better. And that will be the step towards improvement, but it will be small steps. And yeah, we've got a big mountain, so not easy.
Any more? Yes.
Hi. Thanks for a wonderful discussion. You mentioned that a lot of people who practice, they're straying from the religions, whether it be Christianity, Jainism, or Islam. They're straying from this idea of non-harm, this idea of vegetarianism, this idea of respect, not only for animals, but for those around us. But what we see in today's world is this idea of replacing meat with maybe a meat-like substitute. So it's still the idea of meat. I still want to have this flavor, this entire thing, but it's made in a different way. Now, this particular type of faw meat, does it fulfill the criteria of, say, environmental consciousness, right? Being conscious of one's environment? Does it fulfill the original tenets of sort of Hinduism or Jainism, when we have, say, chicken muscle protein grown into rice varieties? Does it fulfill the primary tenets of Islam, when there's still some idea of feeling, some idea of pain that is felt and not minimized by this process, either through its manufacture or indirectly?
It was about a question about if it's appreciated that many of the religions fall short in terms of, you know, the treatment of animals. Would the substitution of either cultivated meat or sort of meat substitutes, do they fulfil? Would they also fulfil sort of the religious requirements as well? Because they might sometimes also include some sort of exploitation of resources in a different way.
Can I just say, there is a book just published on cultivated meat, which my colleague Philip might have on him. Do you have it? No, but
there's
never mind. Anyway,
there
is a session on it at 6 o'clock today in the Oxford Martin School. I've personally been a vegan for ages, 49 years, but... And when I started, it was very useful to have plant-based meat substitutes. Then gradually I went back to sort of lentils and beans and tofu. But the cultivated meat, I think, It's not something I'm personally ever going to eat, but I think it could be hugely important in helping people who really love the taste of meat, but who don't really want to go on eating animals. And so I think it could be a huge step in helping them to move away from eating animals. And to be honest, if we're going to save the earth and biodiversity and the soil and the climate, if we don't reduce our meat consumption, we're in trouble.
I think from a religious point of view, you know, we've all talked about compassion for animals and wildlife, and this idea of cultivated meat and plant-based meats or meat alternatives, you know, does fit in quite nicely with that, because you're not harming individual animals by making those. Yes, there is a environmental impact perhaps in the process of making them, but from certainly from an Islamic point of view, there'd be no problems with eating either of them. And I think, you know, the reason I stopped eating meat is not because I didn't like the texture of meat or the taste of meat, and there are times that I miss that. It's the idea of mass production of meat and the way animals are treated. And so I'd be quite happy. I don't eat plant-based meat alternatives because they're ultra-processed foods, and from a health point of view, they're not brilliant. But that isn't the reason I stopped eating meat. I stopped eating it from an ethical point of view. But I do think it fits quite well with some of our religion viewpoints when it comes to treating animals well.
Another question.
So, the slaughter part of eating animals is obviously quite horrific, in my opinion. And I know some of the speakers up there have addressed those things in terms of from a religious viewpoint. But the welfare of the animals and how they're produced in a sort of industrial farming way is so concerning, and that just seems to be on an exponential rise, and that's with, you know, increasing population of our planet and also increasing wealth of countries now eating more meat. And that to me seems to be something that I think it's just very difficult, and it's very difficult to stop that, and it really concerns me. And I don't see a sort of connect between what religions can teach in terms of being kind to all beings around us and how they are treated in the industrial farming sort of way. And that, I just find it very difficult to see how we can sort of go back to a kinder way of raising livestock.
I'm not cutting you off, but I'm just conscious that we do have to finish it. So as a kind of closing idea, that I suppose that the questioner is saying that there seems to be a disconnect between the fact that there is an exponential rise in industrial farming processes and in the demand for meat globally, even as there is an increasing recognition that there is something wrong with the way it's been doing. And I suppose what you're asking is really, is there anything effective that religions can do to try and correct this?
Well, can I...
Yeah, more politics rather than religion. Yeah. Thanks. Yes.
Well, I do believe that we ought to go deeper into our own faiths, actually, and we'll find, especially if you're from within the Christian or Hebrew tradition, the Bible, looking at it more carefully about the language it uses, what it says about the care of animals and creation. As at the earlier point I made, that we're now so distant from where our ancestors were in terms of tilling the land and so on. So getting a bit better knowledge how food comes to us and paying much more attention to what we eat, as Amir said.
I would really add to that, yeah, that this going deeper into our own traditions is where it's at, because the real core of what drives the problem of suffering from the perspective of these ancient Indian perspectives, it's, you know, desire. So this endless greed and craving that is behind the constant lust for more is the problem. And so any kind of substitution process in the end doesn't deal with the problem. It's like, you know, getting hooked on a vape instead of cigarettes. And so if we really get to the core of it, we need to make do with less. And that's not a very palatable message for politicians to sell, unfortunately. It's not a vote winner. And that's the struggle we're up against.
As I said at the beginning, because 80% of the global population say they belong to a faith, I mean, maybe some very much and some in a sort of vague way. But I mean, I always think, wouldn't it be lovely if at least once a year, every imam, priest, vicar, whatever, used the weekly sermon to talk about our relationship with animals. And I mean, you know, a few do, but it's only a few. So I would really throw that challenge out there. So if you are a person of faith, do get onto your local whatever person leader and, you know, give them a copy of the book or challenge them. Say it would be lovely, perhaps on, you know, World Animals Day in October or something, you could preach something about our relationship with animals. Because if we don't create that kind of movement from the faithful of whatever faith, then, you know, the situation may not get better. But if you imagine if 80% of the global population said, I will not eat meat from factory farmed animals, I will not use cosmetics tested on animals, I'll stop hunting, I won't go and watch that bullfight, you know, I won't do the elephant ride when I go on my Far Eastern holiday. There's so many things that we could all do and also challenge those around us and the faith leaders.
Thank you very much indeed for your questions. Joyce's book, which I thoroughly recommend, is a really thorough study and really readable. is on sale at the back. And today, Blackwell's are doing a special offer on it, but for today only. So please do get your copy, if you will. Otherwise, I would like to thank our fantastic panel. Really fascinating subject. Thank you very much indeed.